If you went on a road trip and you didn't stop for a Big Mac or drop a crispy fry between the car seats or use your McDonald's bag as a placemat, then that wasn't a road trip. It was just a really long drive. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's.
If you're thinking, I should go for a run today, but it looks like it could rain, Sierra says save on epic rain jackets. If you're also thinking, but I can't go out in these beat-up old running shoes, Sierra says, save on top brand running shoes. And if you're still thinking, but I'm also busy performing brain surgery, well, then we say, you really should have led with that. Sierra, let's get moving to your local store, like now. Go!
Hello, and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the new podcast from the makers of BBC Sky and Night magazine. I'm Kev Lotchen, and I'm joined in the studio today by BBC Sky and Night magazine news editor Elizabeth Pearson.
Hello.
And editor assistant Ian Todd.
Hello.
Doing all right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and doing well.
Good.
What about you, Kev?
I am excited for a new podcast, which is either going to go brilliantly or terribly, terribly wrong. So, coming up, we've got a few things in the show. Ian, you're talking to Ben Miller of Armstrong and Miller fame.
Exactly.
But yeah. Not about comedy.
No, Ben Miller basically left his physics PhD to pursue comedy, and obviously is now the comedian and actor we know today. And since his kind of success, he has gone back to writing books. This is his second one, and it's called The Aliens Are Coming, and it's about the search for extraterrestrial life.
Excellent. We'll get onto that a bit later. I'm going to hear from Pete Lawrence as well, who's going to be telling us what you should be looking at in the night sky this month. But first, we better get on and talk about what's been happening since we've been away. Biggest news story, what do you reckon?
I would say probably Tim Peake controlling the rover from the ISS.
Yes, you went to see him do that, didn't you?
Yes, I did. It was really, it was quite interesting. We went to, in the middle of Stevenage, there was a big warehouse run by Airbus, which they'd mocked up to look as much like Mars as possible.
The warehouse?
They had a big kind of sand pit in it.
Oh, right, not like the outside warehouse.
No. So they had like a big sand pit that was apparently they tried really hard to make it as colour accurate to Mars as possible. Because
right.
What they were trying to test was how well you could use a rover's cameras to navigate around this Martian terrain. So basically what happened is Tim Peake dialed down from the International Space Station.
What, on international dial-up modem kind
no,
of incident?
No, via their sort of internet connection that they have up from the ISS to ground. And so he assumed control of this rover, which was called Bridget. It was actually quite cute. It looked a little bit like Wally. Had these big, like, long neck with a thing on the top that the cameras and the lights, they kind of looked like eyes.
Right.
So it was very sort of anthropomorphic. And so he assumed control, and he'd never seen the Mars Yard before. He'd never piloted this thing before. It was all completely new to him.
Wow.
And so he had to drive the rover into a cave, in inverted commas, which was actually just a darkened bit of the Mars Yard. And he had to do a sort of Easter egg hunt type thing. So there were X's painted on rocks.
Yeah.
And some of them glowed in infrared and some of them didn't. And so he had to use infrared cameras to try... I'm sorry, not infrared, ultraviolet. Mm. So he had to use ultraviolet cameras to find these X's and come out within 2 hours.
So did he find the X's?
He did. He needed to find three and he actually found all five. In fact, he found six because he found one twice.
So the rover doesn't have a map on it then?
No, he had no map or anything. We could see what was going on. It was quite weird because there was two rooms. There was one where you could hear what was going on and like ground control talking to Tim and him talking back down. And you could go out into the Mars Yard and see what was going on. But there wasn't the ability to do both at the same time. So
right.
That was quite an odd experience. But yeah, we could see like the feed that basically what Tim was seeing. And it was not a very good feed, but he seemed to be doing okay.
Did it look kind of like an analogue? So what you were looking at in real life, did it kind of match what he was able to see?
It was a lot lower quality what he could see, obviously.
Yeah.
And it was very, you know, it was a much smaller field of view. And the thing that was really awkward is there was no real depth perception, which actually became a bit of a problem. They thought it might all go horribly wrong about half an hour from the end, because there was this one big boulder that they plonked in the middle of the room, I think on purpose.
When you say a boulder, like, I imagine boulder, it's kind of like the size of, say, a room, it's a big thing.
It was probably about half as big as the rover, so it's probably only about like a foot and a half high.
Okay.
But, you know, it was big enough that it was going to cause the rover problems. Mm. And it started going up on it, and then it stopped. And there was this sort of very kind of like human moment where you could just sort of, like, it almost looked like the rover was going, but I don't like it up here, it's too high. And apparently that's what actually happened. And the fail-safes on the robot kicked in and it refused to go up anymore.
Oh, I didn't realise they had those fail-safes.
Yes, no, they do, because obviously he can't see as well.
Mm.
And there are some things that robots are better at working out. And, you know, I am not in a safe position. It's much easier for the robot to work out than Tim with his tiny little screens.
Yeah, how many kilometres above the Earth, exactly.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
What I want to know is, every time he found an X, did he kind of get a reward in space?
I don't think so. I think there was very much, sort of when I nipped back into the room, there was a kind of, he's being very professional about it, but there was a lot of other people who were just like, no, he needs to find them all. I know he only needs to find three, but it's like, no, this is... It was kind of like a game for him, and it got a bit competitive.
Did you get a feeling that, like, while you're there, did they talk about what they're going to do next after they've done this test? Because it was a success.
Yes. So the idea is for future missions to Mars to harmonise the relationship between humans and robots a lot more. Because at the moment, they're quite disparate, the way that they work. It's either all automatic robotics or it's all people. And the idea is that eventually we'll be able to send people into orbit around the moon or around Mars, and they'll be able to control the robots from orbit. So they don't have to do the dangerous bit of going down there and potentially not being able to get back. The robots can do that bit. But you've got the human brain operating them, and they can cope with things like saying, oh, that looks like an interesting rock, I'm going to go over there.
And presumably I can make decisions a lot quicker, like the distance, the time for radio signals to get back and forth to Mars of Curiosity. Was it 6 minutes?
It depends where it is in its orbit, yeah. But at its closest, I think it's about 8 minutes is the return time, I think.
Right.
4 minutes there, 4 minutes back. And obviously if it's, you know, at the most distant part of its orbit, it can be like half an hour.
There was another suggestion, you know, that for controlling a rover on Mars, you could do it from Phobos, essentially the kind of the Tim Peak in ISS to Earth analog, get an astronaut on Phobos and then control a rover from there, because they thought that Phobos, I think, might have been a bit easier to land on.
It's not with the landing, it's the taking back off again. Because on the moon, you don't really need much oomph to get back off. That's why they could, like, it takes a massive rocket to launch to space from Earth, but like a tiny little thing when they were on the moon. And Mars, it's got less gravity than the Earth. I want to say it's about a third, but I can't remember the exact number. But it's still, that is a lot. You're going to need to be able to produce jet fuel in situ to be able to get back off of Mars again, which is tricky.
Very tricky.
Yeah.
But there must also be kind of Earth-based... you know, reasons to use this technology. I'm assuming there's kind of things like bomb diffusing and things like that.
Yes, exactly. Things like bomb diffusing. The ones that gets mentioned quite a lot is deep sea exploration and doing things in areas with high radiation levels, such as Fukushima reactor and stuff like that.
Yes, absolutely.
Though, of course, with that, you also have to, you know, make it so it doesn't get irradiated within 15 seconds, which is what happens at the moment.
One of the things I also noticed, because you were live tweeting it from our Twitter account and kind of putting videos and stuff, and you kind of noticed just how slow the rover is. I mean, is that slowness necessary, or is there?
It was. Oh, they did tell me it's top speed, and I can't remember now. But it was purposefully going quite slowly because they didn't know what the terrain was like. He couldn't really see very far ahead. He had no depth perception. It could get up a much higher speed. I say much, like, we're still talking, you know, like a foot per second.
Yeah.
But, it took quite a long time to turn as well. That was the thing. Sort of when he was first getting used to it, Tim basically drove it forward for a bit and then just turned on the spot a couple of times. It was like it was doing a little pirouette before driving off into the cave.
We don't really want to talk about it. Is this the rover? Was it? Is it kind of a mock-up of what ExoMars is going to be, or is it something more like Curiosity?
It's this one. It was very much. It was designed to test the camera capabilities of
right.
it. So in terms of its kind of drive systems, they weren't very similar to what's going to be on ExoMars Part 2, if it flies. And because they'd mocked up the yard to look like Mars rather than to have the consistency of Mars. So it was a lot sandier and things like that. And the weights were completely off as well. But it probably is going to be something similar, the rover, if with ExoMars Part 2.
If.
Yes, in 2020 now, not 2018.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it got delayed.
Oh, I know that. Okay, so we can only wait and hope for that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before we move on, I want to try something a bit different for the rest of the news. So, you both have pads in front of you, right?
I do,
and
yes.
I hope you both open. So, we're going to try kind of news bingo. So, I'm going to get into the contest, because you both write news for Sky, so we're going to see how much of it you remember.
Okay.
So I'm going to kind of ask you a couple of things about what's been going on, and we're going to see who does the best, shall we?
Okay.
Goodness, okay.
Goodness. Bye, Jingo. Right, so I have an easy one. Why is everyone so excited about Kepler at the moment?
Because...
You have to write it down. It's not going to be a quiz, but you have to write it down, then we'll talk about it, because otherwise, there's going to be no way of keeping track of...
Okay. No worries. Yeah, no, just because I'd never actually played news bingo before.
This actually isn't how bingo works, not that you realise that.
Okay,
so what do you think?
What I think? I think that Kepler... discovered more planets than they thought it would. There was a big dump of, I think it was about 1,200.
Yeah, that's basically right, Ian.
Yeah, I think it has verified just over 1,200 of the planets that exoplanets it has discovered, 550 of which could be rocky like Earth, and 9 of which could potentially have life.
Do you like have the press release on that?
No, I just...
You're absolutely right, of course. It's like it's super planet hall. It's found more than... it's the largest announcement of exoplanets ever. It's half of all the planets Kepler's ever found, and you're quite right. 550, I think, they're in the habitable zone of the stars, and a few could be rocky. But still, none of them are a true Earth analog yet. So that's still a big thing. But I quite like this. When this story was added to the Kepler Exoplanet Archive website, which is where they kind of do keep the accounts from all sources, they said, we found 1,284 planets, in brackets, not a typo. We have to make absolutely sure. It's like, no. Do you know how they did it? How they've suddenly come up with verifying so many planets so quickly?
Wasn't it like it was like a probability thing? Like it had to, each candidate had to pass this 99% probability?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, because normally, before, they were verifying them based on kind of ground-based observations. So you kind of look at it a few times, and if it's, the dips today, you say, okay, that's definite dip, that's probably a planet. Now this analysis, analyzes how likely it is that a brightness dip of a star is caused by a planet in 99% pass rate, it is.
Yeah.
But there was something like 420, 460, something like that. They were false positives as well.
Mm.
So it's doing exactly the opposite and cutting them out.
I kind of thought that story was nicely timed because it was either just after or just before the Mercury transit. So we'd kind of seen what a transit looks like, and then we kind of learn how transits can be used to discover planets.
I don't suppose you know how much of the sun's light Mercury's transit blocks.
No.
I do want because it's so tiny.
It was like 1/150th.
Really?
That was like the size of Mercury comparison. Like that was how Mercury would appear.
Diameter rather
than... across the sun.
Rather than surface area.
Because I wonder whether you'd actually be able to see a planet the size of Mercury. Because a lot of the ones we find hot Jupiters being by name because they're... big like Jupiter.
Yeah, it needs to be quite big and quite close because then it blocks out more a larger percentage of the planet's, of the sun's light.
All right, let's move on to the next one.
Okay.
So, astronomers, you know astronomers have discovered a moon around the Kuiper Belt dwarf planet Makemake, right?
Yes.
Why has it surprised them? I didn't say it was going to be easy. I know you both right at these. I wasn't going to say, oh, what's happened around Makemake?
Oh, no, that's the other one.
Yeah. Why did it surprise them?
Any ideas?
Was it because it did previously, like, falsely verified that there wasn't a moon or something?
No, not quite.
There was one that was the... I think it was a different Kuiper Belt object. They realised that it was a lot of a tighter orbit than they thought it was. But I have a feeling that was Haumea, not Makemake.
Makemake, the surprising thing was they hadn't found it sooner.
Ah.
Because there have been several searches for this moon going back over decades. So they kind of assumed there would be a moon, but they thought it would be a moon that is fainter than anything that was possessed by Pluto. Now, bear in mind that Pluto's moons are 100,000 times fainter than Pluto is itself. And you know, I mean, I'd realise it's a relative brightness thing, but the difference between the brightness of Pluto and Makemake is only about 3 magnitudes.
Mm-hmm.
The moon they found, which doesn't have a name yet, is only 1,300 times fainter than Makemake itself. So they were kind of shocked. It's like, where has this moon come from?
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that its orbit is edge on. So all these times, it is just lost in the glare of the planet.
So you only sort of see it when it's at one extreme end or the other.
Exactly, yeah. It's like, it seems to be a bit like, and this is my kind of paraphrasing, not theirs, it's like you're trying to catch a comet in the solar system, it's only going to be there a tiny amount of time.
Yeah.
Cool.
Right. You're both level pegging at the moment, which is kind of good.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what I actually expected.
Well, how many are left?
Two more.
Okay.
I should have done an odd number, really,
We'll
think about that for next time. So, February, scientists announced the first detection of gravitational waves. So most scientists attribute this to a merger of a pair of big black holes. What's the alternative solution that caused the gravitational waves?
Hmm.
Go.
I think I read somewhere that they think it might have been caused by neutron stars rather than black holes.
Oh, you're so close. Ian, do you
know? No, my guess was something to do with dark matter. It was a headline I'd read earlier on.
You're also quite... I wondered if you might have known this, because you wrote an article a while ago about hypothetical stars.
Yes.
And this kind of is one. It's a gravitational vacuum star.
Cool.
Your what now?
Yeah, exactly. Gravistar.
Okay.
A bit of a nicer name. But it's supposed to be a dense ball of matter that's kept inflated by a core of dark energy. Now, I don't know if that helps you visualise it. It doesn't help me visualise it at all. But obviously, it's never been seen. But scientists say that basically all the evidence that supports the existence of black holes could also support a gravistar. Interesting is because... The kind of the key difference seems to be a gravistar doesn't have a single event horizon.
Mm-hmm.
So what you get, instead of the black hole, you get a light ring circling the gravistar. But I kind of thought, like, they're saying, oh no, gravitational waves, they definitely exist, and they kind of assume there might be wrong with gravistars. But even one of the guys who is part of the LIGO team is B.S. Sophia Prakash of Cardiff University. He says that their signal is consistent with both the formation of black hole and horizonless object. They just can't tell.
Mm.
Hmm. How are you finding? Is this trickier than you thought it would be?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, okay. So we're going to end on an and finally kind of one. Large Hadron Collider, the great big atom smasher beneath the Franco-Swiss border, was due to start up in spring after some maintenance work, but it was delayed. Why?
I know this one. Indicated.
I think I only know this because I remember you telling me about it.
Well, in that case, Ian, tell us what you think.
I could be getting this wrong, obviously, but was it something to do with, like, birds? Was it birds nesting somewhere they shouldn't have been?
No, not quite.
It was a small weasel-like rodent chewed through a power cable or something.
Basically, yes.
And they did not find much left of the small weasel-like rodent animal.
I think the way you put it is the unfortunate animal did not survive its encounter with, what was it, a 66 kilovolt transformer. Yeah, it was a weasel. It was a beech mime, which is a weasel. I got in and had a little snack. It turned out not to be edible.
Yeah. There's loads of really weird things that have stopped the LHC. Beer bottles. I'm pretty sure there was a baguette at some point.
So that's the bird thing that you're thinking of. It was a bird dropped a baguette. And you think seagulls are bad. Dropped a baguette onto a power line, which the result of that is it caused a failure in the cooling system.
Mm. Genuinely dropped a baguette? I thought you were just adding all the ridiculous scenarios together to make one.
No.
That genuinely happened.
I can't remember if that was an incident or there was another one, but there is a famous thing where in the logbook of the LHD somewhere it says, oh, expletive, there's been a big bang. Which this was at the time when there was lots of things in the papers saying the LHC is going to kill us all, it's going to create a black hole and destroy the universe.
So is that right when it started up?
Right when it started. When it restarted back in 2000 and something, when it was the LHC rather than the thing that came before. And so then a lot of people picked up on the fact that they said, oh, there's been a big bang, we're all going to die. And it's like, no. There was just literally a big bang.
Do you know how the users of Reddit reacted to the start of the LHC and all those rumours they were going to create a black hole underneath?
No, I don't know this story.
They sent the LHC a red crowbar.
A red crowbar?
Yes.
Is that a Half-Life reference?
Yes, absolutely is. There was actually a chap, but it also did rounds. About when it started, there was a chap at LHC who looked remarkably like Gordon Freeman, who is the eponymous hero of Half-Life. It's not eponymous, he's just the hero.
Always a physicist who looks remarkably like Gordon Freeman. And if there's not, one will become to look like Gordon Freeman.
We'll leave that there. As you've kind of won bingo, 2-1.
Hey!
Unfortunately, there isn't a trophy. Maybe I'll get one for next. I know.
I'm sure we won't keep track as time goes on.
Oh, actually, no, I'm going to
get horribly competitive.
I'm going to make a board behind you. I'll make a board. I'll put a photo of it online on our Twitter.
Okay, great.
Right, so we should move on to my thing. So next up, we're going to hear from Pete Lawrence, who's going to tell us what you should be looking at in the sky this month.
Observing the night sky in June and July can be quite challenging because the sky never really gets properly dark. But there is one phenomenon which appears at this time of year which I really love going out and trying to see, and that's the phenomenon of noctilucent or night shining clouds. Now, it may sound like I've lost the plot here and I'm moving into the realms of meteorology, but noctilucent clouds do have a link with astronomy. They're the highest clouds on the planet. They occur in a very thin layer in an atmospheric layer called the mesosphere, in a thin layer which is 76 to 85 kilometers up. Now, at that height, when the sun is below the horizon for us in the UK, when we're standing on the ground, if you happen to be up at that height, looking back towards the sun would actually appear above the horizon. So if any clouds form in that layer, they're able to reflect sunlight. So when you're standing on the ground in the dark, or as dark as it gets anyway, you can sometimes see these clouds reflecting the sunlight. So they appear to shine at night, which is why they're called noctilucent clouds. Now, the astronomical link here is that the supercooled water vapor, which is in that layer, needs something to nucleate around. It needs to form little tiny ice crystals. And those particles which cause that to happen are believed to be the fragments left behind when meteors vaporize in the Earth's atmosphere. So that's why it's linked to astronomy. Now, if they do appear at all, you can typically see them 90 to 120 minutes after sunset, low down, very close to the northwestern horizon. Now, bear in mind, when I say low down, they can be very low down indeed. So if you've got anything in the way there, like buildings or trees, noctilucent clouds are very good at hiding behind those features. So make sure you get a nice, clear view in that direction. The other time to typically see them is similar time, 90 to 120 minutes before sunrise, but this time low down in close to the northeastern horizon. So basically, that's where the sun would be below the horizon, so you're seeing the reflected sunlight directly there. Now, if you get a really good display of noctilucent clouds, they can be pretty spectacular. And what can happen then is that you get a noctilucent cloud display low down close to the northwestern horizon, but as the sun tracks below the northern horizon, so the cloud display moves along with it. It moves round to the north and then ends in the northeast. The beauty of noctilucent clouds is you don't really need anything special to view them, just your eyes. If you've got a camera, you can set your camera up on a tripod and take some photographs of them. And if you get a bright display, even a smartphone camera can pick them up. So you thought you were going to have a good rest throughout the summer period with a very short period of night sky. That's gone out of the window now. You now need to go out and hunt for these elusive clouds. Good luck.
Well, up next, I'm speaking to Ben Miller about his new book, The Aliens Are Coming. We get sent in quite a lot of books into the Sky Night magazine desk. And when this one came in, we kind of thought we should probably speak to Ben Miller about it because, as I said at the start of the podcast, he was basically doing his PhD in physics at Cambridge when he got into comedy and then became an actor and a kind of well-known comedian on TV. But now he's returned to science, and this book is looking at extraterrestrial life. So we spoke to him about it, and it's really, really interesting hearing his points of view on the subject and how it kind of all comes from a love of the notion of aliens when he was a child, and how writing the book also made him rethink the notion of biology and the notion of life and what life actually is. Ben, thanks very much for joining me and talking to me.
Well, thank you for having me. Hello.
I suppose the first question I should ask is, are the aliens indeed coming?
No. Well, that is a question that I do try and answer in the book. I think I would have to say there are some very exciting prospects on the horizon. So I think probably the most exciting thing is looking at nearby planets of sun-like stars over the next 10 years, and being able to look at those planets in the infrared and see whether they have atmospheres that might indicate they have life. So basically, our first brush with life will probably be in the form of the image from an infrared telescope. So it's maybe not what people are expecting in terms of a handshake with a grey alien on the White House lawn. But there's a great argument to say that we're also getting a little bit warmer in the search for in extraterrestrial intelligent alien life as well.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it's not really that long since we kind of started discovering exoplanets and things. So we're really only at the kind of beginning of properly looking for extraterrestrial life. And yet it seems that we're, well, obviously closer than we've ever been.
Well, exactly. I mean, the thing is, the speed of the search is increasing at an extraordinary rate, you know. So, Frank Drake, who began searching for radio signals, for example, in the 1960s, managed to search as a handful of stars. Now we're aiming to search the nearest million stars within the next 10 years. So we're starting only now, just beginning to sample enough of the galaxy to get some kind of answer as to whether there is any other technologically similar intelligent alien life out there, you know.
Yeah, and when people kind of think of the notion of alien life, I suppose people kind of think of, as you said, you know, little grey men or aliens that we've seen in sci-fi. But I suppose if we do find life, it's probably quite likely to be something quite different, isn't it? It's not likely to be a creature with four limbs and a head.
That's right. Yes, in sci-fi, you are of course limited. The casting pool is purely Homo sapiens, so everything has to resemble us to some extent. Interestingly, there's a lot of really good arguments. And one of the things the book is really an excuse to go into all sorts of fascinating science about life. And one of the really interesting things about evolution, of course, is that it not only produces different species, but it also quite often finds the same solutions to the same problems. You know, so say, for example, limbs and eyes and teeth and scales crop up on all branches, on all branches of the sort of animal family tree. So we can also kind of expect that might not look exactly human, but that aliens also might have eyes and ears and all the other kind of traits that we find on Earth life, just not necessarily in the same order.
That is a primary concern of the book as well, isn't it? It's also tackling the notion of life and where it all began and how it all began.
Well, yeah, one of the things I really like, I wrote a book before this called It's Not Rocket Science, which was basically a kind of bird's eye view of my sort of favourite bits of science. But one bit I had to leave out was entropy. And it's been something that I've loved, a subject that I've long loved since I started studying science. And this book is also really one of the themes in it, is about an understanding of entropy and how life speeds the increase of entropy in the universe. Because at first glance, life seems to be doing something quite different. It seems to be going against the grain. It seems to be becoming more organized and more complex, where the natural tendency of things is to, you know, run down and become more random and disorganized. So at first glance, life seems to be doing something very unusual. And it's only when you start digging into entropy that you start to really get a glimpse of what's actually going on.
But the interesting thing about your previous book, It's Not Rocket Science, was it was kind of about predicated upon making science accessible for the general public. But with a subject like extraterrestrial life, was it easy to keep the science, so that people who aren't necessarily scientifically minded would be able to enjoy the book?
Well, that is my aim. Unlike a lot of popular science, I am actually aiming at somebody who's bright but doesn't actually have any formal scientific training. So, I'm very much intending that the book is accessible to non-scientists. What's different between this and the first book is the first book is really about what we know, and this book is more about what we don't know.
So what are we actually doing as a species in order to try and find life on other planets? What's the current state of the hunt?
Well, it's a little bit disappointing in terms of robotic missions to planets in our own solar system, because, of course, one of the things we haven't talked about so far is, yes, our telescopes might pick up, might be able to image the atmospheres of nearby planets and figure out whether there's chemical imbalance there and whether there might therefore be life. Our radio telescopes and are sort of scouring the skies looking for radio signals. But there's another, very exciting area, which is other planets within our own solar system. And the ones that people tend to get excited about are the kind of icy moons of Jupiter and Saturn, and also another of the satellites of Saturn called Titan, which has got is a really fascinating place because whereas the Earth sits at the triple point of water, Saturn sits at the triple point of methane. So there's a kind of interesting, an interesting line of argument that would say you could have a very different kind of life there, exploiting methane the same ways that life on our planet exploits water.
What made you want to tackle this subject? What kind of drew you towards this idea?
I've always really been fascinated by science fiction and aliens and the idea of UFOs, and I find all that kind of stuff really interesting. And when I was writing Rocket Science, some of the most fascinating new science I learned was biology. And I thought, well, you know, what can our, you know, state-of-the-art biology tell us about aliens? So it's kind of a way of bringing together my two current favorite topics.
And your foundation was in physics, wasn't it? As you were kind of getting into comedy and acting, you were...
Yeah. Yes, I did. I did a degree in physics, and I also began a PhD in physics, and sadly left to go and for the Free Electric Band. I did sort of begin life as a physicist, and I think that's probably one of the reasons why the biology took me so much by surprise. You know, I kind of wasn't really prepared for some of the amazing advances that have made in biology since I last properly studied it. So, yeah, I mean, that was some of the most fascinating scientists I met, actually, writing the book, were biologists.
Yeah, so that must have been a surprise, you know, coming as a physicist.
Well, yeah, because, you know, when I, you know, it's an awful long time ago that I studied biology, but when I did, it was a bit like, I mean, everyone used to make the joke, it was a bit like stamp collecting, you know, it was a bit kind of like just trying to categorize and to argue with other people's categories. But, you know, biology is really a hard science now, sort of underpinned by mathematics and sort of in particular with the, you know, the biology of life and the origins of life is really underpinned by thermodynamics. So it's kind of, yeah, it's become a really technical subject, and it's all the better for that, I think.
Was astronomy something that you were always interested in?
I was, yeah. I mean, I did. I've always been interested in astronomy, particularly in how, you know, in stellar physics and in galaxy formation. Those were two of the things that in fact, when I did my undergraduate degree, I specialized in the physics of stars and galaxies, whereas when I did my PhD, it was more sort of solid-state physics. So I kind of went from one end of the spectrum to the other, basically.
Okay, and then that obviously led you on to kind of extraterrestrial life and looking to the stars for your new book?
Well, I just think it's really... it's fascinating to try and answer those questions. You know, the big questions like, what is life? How did life start? Is this the only life that exists in the universe? And if it isn't, what's the other life out there like? And I think the difference for me as a schoolboy growing up, faking my UFO Polaroid pictures by dangling, by taking photos and using my fishing rod to sort of dangle potatoes wrapped in tinfoil in front of them to make it look like they were hovering over buildings. Since we used to fake UFO photos and make crop circles in my youth, we've actually come a long way to now sort of starting to answer some of those questions. And I think we're at a really tantalizing point where lots of different branches of science are starting to come together. And probably one of the most important things of all is, you know, they would have laughed you out of town if you tried to write a book. If I tried to write this book, you know, even probably 5 years ago, it would have been just ridiculed. But things are moving so forward so fast that the to talk about the real science of extraterrestrials is something that, you know, people now kind of take seriously. It's amazing.
Right, so we should probably talk about what's coming up in the next issue of BBC Sky and Night magazine, which is the June issue.
Mm-hmm.
As you interviewed Helen Sharman for that one.
I did. It was on the 18th of May. It was the 25th anniversary since Helen Sharman launched into space.
And she, of course, was the first Briton to go into space.
Yes, she was. She applied... she heard an advert on the radio that said astronaut wanted, no experience required.
Which we'd never get now, would we? I mean, you imagine?
I think there might have been something similar that Tim Peake applied for.
Really?
Yes, when they I think they said they're
out
looking
to the
for...
general public, yeah. Like no experience, because Tim Peake is a an Air Force pilot.
Yes, or... yeah, that's yeah. NASA put out public things every couple of years. They sort of say, we're looking for new astronauts.
I did not
give
know
it a
that.
Go. Yeah. So anyway, she applied. 13,000 other people also applied, but she managed to get through and be the one chosen to actually go into space. Now, this was part of something called Project Juno, which was actually a commercial venture. She was being sponsored to go. She was not paid by the UK government.
Uh-huh.
So I interviewed her about her thoughts of what it was like to go into space, what it was like to be the first Briton, and also how the kind of the British view of the space industry has changed in the last 25 years.
And we can read all about that in the magazine.
Yes, you can.
Excellent. Also in this issue, we're going to be telling you how you can see the ringed wonder Saturn for yourself for the first time through a telescope. You've never seen it before. Absolutely should. It's the astronomical object that people most say, wow, this is amazing. This is what gets people into astronomy. Also, the phone you have in your pocket is absolutely wonderful for taking photos of the night sky. You may not believe it, but Pete Lawrence is going to be telling us how you can capture some absolutely stunning shots without investing in any high-tech kit. Mm. And we're also going to be looking at how the seasons of Mars, because Mars has seasons, all the planets have seasons, but how the seasons of Mars change what we see on the surface of the red planet. Plus, we have our monthly sky guide and equipment reviews. Anything else, guys?
Well, just on the subject of gravitational waves, for this month's bonus content, I spoke to Dr. David Reitze, who is the executive director of the LIGO experiment, kind of trying to break down the tricky science and physics into something that we can, us mere mortals, can understand. I spoke to Dr. Reitze, and that's available in the bonus content this month.
And of course, we have all our brilliant regular features showing you the best things that you can see in space, some of our readers' best images, all of the latest news, and also catching up with Maggie Adarin-Pocock and John Corkshaw.
Awesome. BBC Skylight Magazine is available in print and in several digital formats. You can find out more at skylightmagazine.com/subscribe, or you can look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store. So, this has been Radio Astronomy. We have been BBC Sky at Night magazine, and we'll be back in a month's time.